Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is James Pisano, a partner at the Denham Group. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, James, what I always like to do before getting into the main part of the recording is to give my guests a chance to provide more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So, James, the floor is yours.
All right. So I'm a partner at the Dedham Group. We're a strategy consulting firm focused in the pharmaceutical space. Most of my time over the past 8 years here has been spent figuring out ways to enhance access for specialty therapeutics. I mostly work in the immunology, rare disease, and the neuroscience space, particularly behavioral health.
So, James, I'm always interested to know as well, what got you into healthcare in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was 15 years old, my first job in high school was working at a psychiatrist's office, basically doing anything they needed, cleaning up the garden, filing papers, painting fences. At that same time, my girlfriend's parents, now my in-laws, worked in the psychiatric space. So my mother-in-law was a director of a state psychiatric hospital, and my father-in-law was a psychiatric nurse. So I got to see and hear about two really interesting sides of behavioral health at that time in my life. One that was more outpatient focused and treating, you know, challenges that many people experience, and others that are more severe, patients with schizophrenia, you know, bipolar disorder, et cetera. So got to see the impact on everybody's lives, and that really resonated and kind of pushed me closer and closer to the healthcare space.
Yeah. And kind of, as you said, that early experience was around behavioral health. And I know you mentioned that in your current role, you do, you know, part of your focus is on behavioral health. So, you know, kind of how were you able to pursue that and then, you know, make that, you know, part of your ongoing professional career?
Yeah, I got lucky is the short answer to that. After joining the Dedham Group, I spent maybe a year working only in immunology, and we got a few projects in the behavioral health space that were very focused on patients living with schizophrenia. And I became really interested in not only the challenges they experience in getting access to medication, but just more broadly, how different social determinants and, you know, overall symptoms of the disease kind of impact your ability to get and access healthcare services. So, you know, in that journey, I really latched onto it. And it's something that I've pursued in my career ever since, trying to stay close to those dynamics.
Yeah, so kind of, as you said, if you've been able to pursue those dynamics through your career, what are your current you know, main areas of focus when it comes to behavioral health?
Yeah, great question. So we work a lot on behalf of pharmaceutical manufacturers. So a lot of emerging or current treatment options that are on market for conditions like, you know, what I've mentioned, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, et cetera. And in working with those treatments, not only do we try to better understand how to get product to patient more effectively, but you know, why I like the behavioral healthcare space so much is because, you know, the real way to get more products stable on patients, more patients stable on product, excuse me, is to fix a lot of the other challenges that they experience. You know, get them covered by the appropriate insurance, help them navigate any cost challenges they have. Just consistent access to a provider in the first place, right, is critical to getting on, you know, appropriate treatment. So I really enjoyed those dynamics, and I've been able to learn a lot about the evolving healthcare space just through access to these specialty treatments.
And when you're talking about that access and the challenges to access, I think you kind of alluded to insurance a little bit, but, you know, can you kind of elaborate on what those challenges are and, you know, if you're able to provide examples of how they kind of arise in the real world?
Of course. Yeah. So just sticking with the theme of insurance, one thing I'm passionate about is this idea that everything in behavioral health and really all of medicine is treated on a, you know, a fee-for-service basis, except of course for value-based care programs, which are emerging and growing, thankfully. But traditionally, it's all been fee-for-service. And in the mental health space, what that means a lot of times is providers are only incentivized to do what is reimbursable in terms of service, right? They're looking at how they spend their time. What you can reimburse for is all you're getting paid for. So I think models that incentivize a more holistic treatment of the patient, like whole person care, more collaborative care models. You know, there's a few out there that are very promising that I've followed quite closely over the years. I think they really enable treatment of things other than just a diagnosis. which is, in my opinion, one of the biggest challenges that patients face.
And so if you're talking about, you know, that challenge of only wanting to provide a reimbursable service, which from a business perspective makes clear sense, is that implying that not all of the appropriate behavioral health services or care that could be provided would necessarily be covered?
Yeah, I mean, something as simple as making sure a patient who's maybe food insecure or homeless has a place to go after their appointment and putting them in a, you know, an environment where they're more likely to show up to their next appointment is extremely important for effective treatment, right? And those aren't necessarily things you can bill a HCPCS code for, you know, to an insurance company and get paid for. Of course, you know, those services are provided by, you know, agencies out there, but it's not necessarily something that's directly incentivized by the medical model of, you know, behavioral health treatment.
Yeah, and kind of as I think you're suggesting as well, it's, you know, in your reference to, you know, whole person care and collaborative care, it's really trying to expand the definition of what's meant by a healthcare service, whether you're talking a physical or mental health service, because, you know, as you're just highlighting it, it really is the intersection of so many different factors and influences that can impact health.
Absolutely. There's a model that I've followed for quite a while, Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, CCBHCs, that was funded by SAMHSA and it started by the National Council for Behavioral Health. And the model essentially, you know, looks to prove that if you give funding to treatment centers in a way that enables all these extra services, and you basically ask the social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, what do you need to effectively treat this patient versus giving them a list of things they can bill for, you know, there will be better outcomes and, you know, it will treat these patients in a more cost-effective way. We'll see less use of crisis services, less, you know, visits to the emergency department, and overall more consistent treatment of these patients. So I'm a big believer in that model. And that's, you know, if you ask about challenges with the payer model, I think that's one of the big ones is that has yet to be really proven at a large scale for many reasons. And I hope we can move closer and closer to that and away from just strictly fee-for-service.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting model that I'm not sure I've really heard about before. So, you know, is it really kind of just community focused or, you know, kind of what were some of the drivers of that experiment?
Yeah, so it's it was largely focused on patients with severe mental illness in the community setting, right? So funding was given to clinics that were certified at a state level. And there were initially 10 states in the demonstration program to prove, you know, with the Congressional Budget Office that this would be a cost-effective or at best, worst a cost-neutral program. And, you know, they have to provide these same services with respect to substance abuse treatment and mental health, you know, all kinds of mental health treatment. They mandate things like integration with physical health care or, you know, creating connections with local hospitals to make sure that there's continuity of care for patients that are hospitalized and transition back to the community setting. It offers fundings for things like improvements in electronic health records and risk stratification of patients, all these great services that, again, normally aren't funded through a fee-for-service model. And it's been going for, I think, 6 years now, the demonstration states, and they've been able to prove success so far.
So kind of given that, you know, and understanding that the industry has, you know, different perspectives on things, you know, what do you think might be necessary for broader uptake of a similar model, you know, say in commercial insurance or, you know, just in other government insurance programs?
That's an excellent question. I think that one of the challenges with commercial insurance or managed care in general has been fragmentation in how the you know, the services are covered across physical and behavioral health care, right? So you imagine if you are depressed, it's, you know, you may not be willing to take your pills that treat your physical health conditions, or you may have episodes, you know, with respect to your behavioral health conditions that exacerbate physical health symptoms, right? And I think that tie of, you know, the integration of physical and behavioral health care, not just in a community setting at the provider level, but at the payer level, is really important to see the impact of some of these, you know, new payment models and new approaches to treatment delivery. You know, if you asked a few years ago what the overall coverage landscape looked like in commercial, a lot of the behavioral health management was farmed out to third-party behavioral health organizations. And they were basically acting as a, you know, a vendor for these payers, commercial payers, to help design services, manage the network, you know, pay the claims, et cetera. I think that fragments the data. It makes it difficult to kind of treat the patient as a, you know, a whole patient for all their behavioral and physical health needs. And we're starting to see the insourcing of a lot of those services after the past, over the past few years, two or three. So hopefully in the future that will, you know, make it easier for payers to actually assess the patient's, you know, the impact of the behavioral health challenges that the patient experiences. And maybe, you know, evaluate patients that are treated in these different models and see how their overall, you know, costs change, or obviously cost is number one to payer, but, you know, how their outcomes change and experience changes as well.
Yeah. And kind of picking up on the fact that you're talking about that fragmentation, kind of the pushing out of behavioral health coverage, what does the coverage of behavioral health look like? You know, is it on par with physical health, or kind of what are some of the distinctions that, you know, historically have been seen from that coverage perspective?
Yeah, there's been quite an evolution over time. It's supposed to be parity. There are laws in place to try to support parity coverage for physical and behavioral health. And that has really evolved since, you know, the mid-90s, where initially the only thing that was covered was basically you couldn't have, you know, these lifetime maximums on visits, right? And it did not cover substance use, and it was limited to select types of covered patients, right? But as that's evolved over time, we see that, you know, in 2008, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was passed. And that really expanded this to kind of put behavioral health and medical health on the same playing field with respect to things like cost share and, you know, overall number of visits that are allowed and annual maximums, et cetera. You can't treat the two differently. So from a plan design perspective, I think we've seen improvements, although it's certainly not perfect. With this act also came other strategies to try to support parity access. Kind of two different areas. One is quantitative measures, right? And the other is non-quantitative measures to support parity coverage of mental health with this MHP AEA. And what we see with the quantitative measures are things like, you know, cost share, days or visits allowed, overall cumulative maximums, things that are easily quantifiable from plan design. But the non-quantitative is where we see a lot of shortcomings with respect to actual parity, right? So this is going to be things like prior auth requirements, formulary tier design for prescription drugs, network requirements for providers, right? Just what it takes to actually be in the network, as well as the reimbursement rates that are associated with network inclusion. So these are all supposed to be at parity based on this law, but it's very hard to define exactly what you measure to say that these are at parity. And the enforcement of the law right now is really reliant on patients. You know, it's basically advertised to patients on numerous advocacy websites that these are the things you should be looking for to flag noncompliance with mental health parity laws. And if you do flag noncompliance, it will be evaluated by some web of federal and state, you know, stakeholders that kind of oversee the process. But it's not overseen, and, you know, I don't think the infrastructure is in place to really uphold what was put in place in 2008, even 15 years later.
Yeah, no, definitely a lot to unpack there. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with James Pisano from the Denham Group. We're talking about behavioral health kind of plan designs and now starting to drive into parity. And James, I think you were probably answered it, but I just want to make sure I pull it out a little bit. But when we're talking parity, is that just meaning the plan design is supposed to have the same scope of behavioral health services, or is it supposed to have, you know, some at least minimal level of reimbursement for the services, or is it some combination of that? You know, so if you don't mind just kind of maybe just from your perspective, defining what parity actually means under the law. And then, you know, as I said, from your previous description of it, still a lot to be able to unpack there.
Yeah, of course. So the first thing I'll say is that behavioral health coverage was actually not even mandated by this law. The law basically said, if you cover behavioral health, it should be at parity with medical coverage with respect to certain elements. And those elements are largely with respect to the patient's cost share and allowable services. So things like number of visits or, you know, how many appointments they may have access to, and especially with network management, right? So from a prescriber perspective, the requirements to be in network and the reimbursement should be, you know, at parity with medical coverage.
Yeah, and that seems like a fairly big point that should be called out, that as you said, the 2008 law did not mandate coverage. It just said, if you cover it, then you're supposed to do it. So, you know, without that mandate, you know, arguably it seems like it's a little bit of a toothless tiger, because there's nothing impelling or compelling the insurers to include that coverage in the first place.
Yeah, and we did see evolution since 2008 with the Affordable Care Act that actually did classify behavioral health services as a essential health benefit. So it is covered and subject to all of the coverage requirements under the essential health benefits, which include things like cost share caps. So we have seen some progression since 2008 with respect to federal legislation. But I think the key piece here is, even if there is an intention of parity, the exact way that that's defined at a plan level is tough to measure, number one. And number two, it's really not upheld with respect to any sort of comprehensive infrastructure. You know, it's mostly reliant on patients or advocacy groups to call out any, disparity they see.
Yeah, and kind of as you said, relying on public reporting certainly makes it a much tougher battle. You know, so kind of from that perspective, as you were talking about, you know, there was some expansion through the ACA, but I think you said having some components of behavioral health be an essential health service. You know, have you seen other kind of recent efforts or changes that would help further encode or require coverage?
Yeah, there's certainly been some activity over the past year, I think particularly with respect to the non-quantitative measures to help more clearly define exactly what should be measured and how, to set a standard at least for what parity looks like. The other piece I would say is telehealth is the other major, you know, evolution in access to mental health services, which, you know, I certainly see both sides of the equation here. Of course, it expands access to treatment and did so in a major way during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it was initially granted expansion for coverage under the public health emergency. But, you know, people, of course, worry about, healthcare inequity with respect to telehealth services as well. Patients may not have access to Wi-Fi or may not have access to, somewhere they can have their treatment quiet, right, in an appropriate environment. I don't think that should hold us back from moving towards and supporting telehealth coverage, but it just requires other ways to get creative to support this infrastructure. But certainly major advancement in overall access to care for many patients.
Yeah, and you just touched upon it, but it seems like this has become a very frequent question that I ask folks over the past year or two. But, you know, it's like, kind of, what were the lessons that were learned as a result of the pandemic? And, you know, what advancements did you see other than, you know, that telehealth, the expansion on the use of telehealth that came out of those lessons?
Yeah, great question. I think overall, the fact that it was possible was the biggest learning. I think for years, there was a push and noise around telehealth, not just in behavioral health, but more broadly in physical health as well. And there was a lot of pushback around the quality of the care that would be delivered and the overall infrastructure changes that would need to take place. And the question of, is this worth it? And I think COVID-19 really put that to the test. And of course, there's a lot of need out there. We were able to, the entire country was able to make it happen, right? That shift. So I think the barrier to change was one of the biggest learnings. The other piece, of course, with respect to access to care, one of the biggest challenges for behavioral health is network management in general. We talked about, how there's supposed to be parity, but still compared to physical health, if you look at, the research, mental health providers are paid less than physical health providers from a reimbursement perspective. And there is, you know, a much larger percentage of providers out of network for behavioral health services, which is more costly for a patient, of course, to be paying for out-of-network services and makes it inaccessible to many. So I think the advent of telehealth really opened up that network. And, you know, you may be 50 miles away from the nearest substance, use specialist, but you may have more access now and don't have to drive an hour each way just to, to get your services. So I think those are, some of the major changes we've seen. Telehealth in terms of infrastructure change is just one. There were a couple of others just with respect to how we deliver mental health, like directly to patients' homes or setting up clinics for things like, medication injections, so patients didn't lose access to their, ongoing you know, medication administration, et cetera, that kind of happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. But overall, I think we saw that we can support that, the sort of infrastructure change if we, you know, if we have to. It's just more a matter of proving, is it worth it?
Yeah. And kind of going back to one of the points that you made in there in terms of that access, where yes, you've had the expanded access, but with the reimbursement levels, you know, I guess from a very broad brush perspective, being lower when you're talking about behavioral health services, you know, I don't know if you necessarily said this, but it's certainly something I've seen suggested in the past that that is what help kind of drives the clinicians to be remain out of network. So that way they can potentially bill more. So is there, you know, any increased awareness or increased desire to try and drive a change on that front from what you've seen?
Not any major changes that I've seen, maybe on a smaller scale, but no broad strokes. There's industries popping up now to help, you know, mental health therapists get, you know, either figure out how to get in network because it's so complicated, and, you know, to help navigate those reimbursement network inclusion requirements, because a lot of the times these mental health providers are more individually based versus like a large, you know, medical practice where you kind of just go onto your, you know, your practices panel. So I think the individual qualifications, there's an industry popping up trying to support that. Additionally, even from an out-of-network perspective, there are companies popping up that try to support mental health providers in figuring out how to give patients, you know, a master bill they can send to their insurance company, or, you know, how do you support out-of-network billing where the patient can easily send the receipt over and get some sort of coverage so they can afford it, but the provider can still, you know, get reimbursed at a higher rate. So I see much more activity on the, you know, on that side of things, trying to help navigate the system we live in today versus a change towards improved reimbursement.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And, you know, obviously, optimistically, you would hope that it would, you know, kind of all align based on, or, you know, kind of consistent with what we were talking about with some of the other parts of the conversation. You know, and then something that also popped to mind is, you know, as you were talking about that expansion of different types of modalities for delivering services that arose because of the pandemic, you know, what role or what impact have you seen of a lot of the, I'll call them more direct-to-consumer, direct-to-patient companies that seem to just be trying to short-circuit all of it and, you know, and from that perspective, thinking about maybe some of those big names that, you know, are on that virtual or telehealth side of things and are just saying, hey, sign up for our service and then you have access to all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it didn't have its place, they wouldn't be successful or making any money, right? So it's certainly fitting a need for some consumers. And I, you know, I support that any day of the week. I think what may be challenging for certain consumers is it's very far outside of the current healthcare delivery model, and I think very far outside of some of the innovation that is happening at a local level to try to integrate physical and behavioral healthcare or treat the patients more holistically. I think this kind of isolates just one very distinct component of your treatment, some of these direct-to-consumer models. But again, it certainly bridges a gap for some patients here. It seems like in general with behavioral health, we're kind of in this, we're always in a catch-up mode, right? We're trying to solve certain issues rather than solving the overall healthcare infrastructure, you know, with respect to a lot of these reimbursement and disparity challenges. So I think until that can be addressed, you know, yeah, you kind of have to be supportive of some of these other models that at least help some patients out there.
Yeah. So it sounds like, as you're saying, it's, you know, obviously there's a need that's being filled and a need that's being met through the services, but at the same time, maybe it's diverting attention away from, you know, kind of what we were talking about right at the beginning of the conversation of we should be trying to drive towards whole person care, really integrated care of everything that a patient or an individual might need because things are interconnected, and just further driving the traditional silos is not going to help advance the ball on that front.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts, but to your point, I would agree with your, you know, last statement summed it up nicely. I don't think it advances necessarily.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of, and I know, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but, you know, what role do you, you know, or what are the other pieces of the treatment modality? Is it's, you know, I know we've talked a lot about, it sounds like, you know, kind of that those person-to-person interactions, but, you know, what else goes into the services that, you know, may be impacted by the challenges that we've talked about in coverage and access?
Yeah. So beyond just, you know, your traditional like psychotherapy, for example, there's inpatient stays, partial hospitalization programs. You know, you have pharmacological treatment, which we haven't really touched on too much yet. And I think for different types of diagnoses or different severities for, you know, across patient types, you know, you'll see a very different treatment and healthcare delivery system experience for those patients, right? So in thinking about some of the patients with severe mental illness, or maybe even some of the more complex treatment options that are coming out, I think they experience very different challenges than what we've talked about today. One example I'll give just in terms of like novel treatments coming out. There's a lot in you know, clinical trials right now with respect to hallucinogenics, and there's only one product on the market really right now for major depressive disorder that is, you know, a controlled substance, a ketamine derivative. And I think as we see more and more treatment options that are not just oral pills launch onto market, we're going to have to see an evolution in how psychiatrists deliver care to their patients. You think of a psychiatry office, it's a desk with a, you know, physician sitting behind it and a patient on the other side, and they're chatting about medication management and dose titration, right? It's not a nurse taking a patient's vitals to ensure that they're not reacting to a medication that may, you know, cause some sort of, you know, psychiatric symptoms or hallucinations, right? So as we see those treatments come out of clinical trials, and, you know, the data's promising so far, I think those manufacturers will experience a challenge bringing them to market unless we see this kind of evolution in the healthcare delivery system. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see kind of what types of provider organizations are at the forefront of that change.
Yeah, no, I think a lot to consider there. And James, unfortunately, believe it or not, we're already almost out of time. So I kind of want to use this to wrap up one final question, which is, you know, kind of based on everything that we've talked about, you know, what has you most optimistic about the future for behavioral health?
Yeah, I'd probably say a few different areas. One, I spoke about the CCBHC initiative earlier. There's a lot of those programs happening at a local level with respect to value-based care. I hope to see the expansion of those, and the outcomes have me very optimistic, just in terms of how they've transformed how care is delivered, outcomes for patients, even how the providers are thinking about, you know, offering treatment to all of their patients. So that has me very excited. The second, I just mentioned the new treatment options coming out. As I said early in the call, I'm mostly on the pharmaceutical side of the business. So I'm excited to see these treatments come out and, you know, kind of get my hands dirty, hopefully, with helping evolve some of the healthcare infrastructure. And I think the last piece really is the, you know, enforcement, hopefully, of the mental health parity laws moving forward. I was happy to see some activity on that this year with respect to how that can be measured. So hopefully that, you know, that only goes up from here.
Yeah, no, certainly a lot to keep in mind and a lot to keep track of. But James, as I said, believe it or not, we're already out of time. So I want to thank my guest, James Pisano, for a great conversation today.
Really enjoyed the time. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.